Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, we are joined by Christopher Thornburg. He is a founding partner of Beacon Economics. Dr. Thornburg is an expert in the study of regional economies, real estate dynamics, labor markets, and business forecasting. Prior to launching Beacon, he worked with UCLA Anderson Forecast, where he regularly authored the outlooks for California, LA, and East Bay. He also received his PhD from the Anderson School. Dr. Thornburg, welcome back.
Good to be here.
We had just started talking about, okay, we're going to incur some debt to solve this problem, and then we're going to have the guts to pay it back. And that was one of your concerns, is how we might try to avoid that.
Right, exactly. If you think back to World War II, we ran up a very significant debt in that four-year period. And what was amazing was we paid it all back within 5-6 years after the war had ended.
Wow.
And that was a debt that's significantly larger as a share of our GDP than what we're dealing with today. As always, I don't have a problem with borrowing. It's just that governments have a tendency, shall we say, to avoid the political... It's easy to borrow and spend. It's tough to raise taxes and pay it back. And we've seen that not just at the federal level, but we're seeing it here at the state level as well. You think about the state problems we have here in California. The big debt we had, the big deficit we had, really started back in late part of the 90s. Yet Schwarzenegger managed to pass that bill, which said we could borrow short-term until we, quote-unquote, got on our feet. We never got on our feet. The only thing they did with that money was allowed the state legislative bodies to avoid having to make any tough decisions, and now we're really in for it. And I'm always afraid that those tough decisions just won't be made.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was going to get to the subject of California, but, I mean, we can't create money here, so that's scary when you have something like a $34 or $40 billion deficit as a state. How do you go about solving that?
Well, let's try to put that in context. You're talking about $40 billion in the context of an economy that's about $1.7, $1.8 trillion in size.
Okay.
What is that, a couple percent?
35.
But $40 billion out of $1.8 trillion?
I missed a decimal point. 3.5.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually a little smaller than that, I think.
Yeah, okay.
We're not talking a big number.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we have a reduction to the ridiculous here. That's a sales tool.
Yeah. I mean, the problem here we have in California is this. This may be a total shock to your listeners. And I talk about this in public, and people are just incredulous when I say this. But you ready for this? We're not a high-tech state.
Okay.
And everybody says, well, that's not true. California is the most tax-unfriendly state in the country. That's simply not the case. When you look at taxes and fees that we pay to our government as a share of our income, it's about 16.8%.
Okay.
Average in the U.S. is about 16.3%.
Okay.
We're a tiny bit above average. If you rank the states, we're number 18. We don't pay that much in terms of taxes and fees.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that how we collect our taxes and fees is just ridiculous. The whole idea that the taxes works this way. We have to have taxes because we have to fund certain public projects. And everybody will tell you the best way to raise those taxes is shallow taxes on a broad base. You want small taxes on lots and lots of things. And what we do in California is we heap tons of taxes on a very small base. For example, we have an insanely progressive income tax. We charge high-income people lots and lots and lots of money, and sort of mid to low-income people almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, sure, we think there's some social fairness involved there, but understand, A, those rich people can get up and go someplace else. In fact, those rich people can get up and go someplace else easier than you and I can. Second thing is high-income people have the greatest fluctuations in their income over the business cycle. Now, it's hard to feel sorry for somebody whose income went from $2 million a year to $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
But for from an income tax perspective, that means we are subjecting ourselves to these horrendous swings in our revenue flows. It doesn't make any sense. And on a third sort of, you know, on that same sort of thing, on the same sort of idea, as much as we have very progressive income taxes, we turn around and we have the most regressive property taxes in the entire United States. Prop 13 is ridiculously regressive. What you do is you have two people living next door to each other, same house, same hunk of land, same view, same school district. One family that's been living here for 30 years has 100% equity in their home, and they're paying a few hundred dollars in taxes. Next door, the new family, the young family, who has like 10% equity in their house, is paying thousands of dollars in taxes. It's shockingly regressive, and yet we are comfortable letting this system exist in our economy, where there's a small group of people, the recent buyers of homes, to pay the large majority of sales taxes. It's really quite sad that when you sit down and think about it, that we can make the state, A, more tax friendly, and B, pay off our expenditure problems, if we just had the political courage to sit back and say, look, we got to throw this whole tax system out and start over.
Now, that's sort of like messing with National Social Security, messing with California Prop 13, the Holy Grail.
You know, I think that if people sat down and really took an objective look at it, they'd see how crazy it was. But you're right. The system is insidious. And the reason it's insidious is because even if you disagree with Prop 13, and many people I talk to, there are a lot of people out there who think Prop 13 is ridiculous. I'm not the only person to voice this opinion. It is not, by any stretch of the imagination, sort of globally entrenched into our mindset. What's interesting, though, is the way it works. You know, once you buy a house, and once your property taxes are locked in, even if you're against it, you're for it. It creates its own support base.
Yes, I guess I'm because I've been a benefactor, I've lived in the same property, about 26 years. Yeah, I'm sure there's a neighbor that probably has a tax bill that's at least 300, if not 400% higher than I have.
Hey, I'm sure there are. And while you may be against it on a principle basis, you, of course, you know, you individually are saying, well, you know, I don't like it, but am I really going to go out and spend money on a campaign to get rid of it? Well, that would be kind of individually foolish, you know.
Now, on that one, you do have that has to be voted out. Is that correct?
Well, that is actually a proposition. You would probably have to have another proposition to get rid of it.
To overturn that.
Yeah, you have to have a proposition to get rid of it.
Okay. Let's talk about a twist that just happened last week I didn't really expect. Citibank kind of signed on to approve the concept of cram downs.
Now, wait. Hang on. Hold on.
All right.
Citibank, the week before, received how many billion dollars in rescue funds?
Okay. So you're saying that was politically motivated?
I don't know that. and I would hate to start any conspiracy theories, but it is awful coincidental.
Yeah. Now, do you see, I mean, what would you think the outcome of that would be, and do you think that's got any chance of happening?
You know, anything's possible in this environment. We have a brand new administration in place. We clearly have a government that is much more on the left end of things. We no longer have a president who would, you know, instantaneously veto something like that. However, I would put two things in your mind on this concept. A is the way they want to quote unquote do cram downs is not en masse, if you will, but rather through the bankruptcy system. And of course, that would immediately incur, it would immediately cause lots of people to have to go bankrupt. Certainly, lots of people might declare bankruptcy to go that route, but it certainly does impose costs above and beyond just losing your home if you happen to go the bankruptcy route. You know, a lot of people out there may have other assets out there that they're not willing to put on the line if they walk in front of a bankruptcy judge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably really only people who have nothing but that house and they're way underwater would actually go that particular route. Second thing to keep in mind on there is I don't care how left-leaning that bankruptcy judge is, would they really be able to have someone walk into the court and say, yes, Your Honor, I actually earned $60,000 that year, but I put down that I earned $120,000 on my mortgage application, and yes, I swore to that fact, you know, and had a notary there, you know, watching me sign it.
Well, you know, you just brought up the missing question in all of this.
Yeah.
We don't really put much pressure on the people that exaggerated what they earned.
Well, the FBI came out very early in this game and said, yes, this constitutes fraud. No, we are not going to prosecute it, and we're not going to prosecute it simply because there are so many people out there who did it that if we tried to prosecute it, we would functionally cease every other activity of the FBI. So they were being, shall we say, I think they were being realistic.
Yeah.
But it's not to say that it isn't a crime, and if you show up in front of a judge and acknowledge that crime, will that judge actually be willing to cram down your mortgage? I would hope not. And so while they're saying this is going to happen, I wonder actually how effective it would be and how many people would actually receive that benefit.
Okay. I would hope that it wouldn't pass because I think, unfortunately, it would probably be attempted by a lot of people. So,
I agree with you. I hope it doesn't pass. But I think my point is it might, regardless of what you and I may wish. But then also to temper your thoughts on that, to say that it may not be quite the seismic event that you might fear it would be.
Well, I guess what I was thinking is they would go for the first stage of bankruptcy where they just get adjusted payments.
Well, again, you can't just adjust somebody's payment. You got to cram down the mortgage. I mean, the programs that have been put into place up to this point in time have failed miserably. I mean, you look at things like this Project Hope, for example, and the recidivism rate. You know, of the people who went through Project Hope, 50% have redefaulted within 3 months of coming out of that program. And the problem is every one of those things, they only concentrate on the payment, which is ridiculous. If you're $200,000 underwater, you're $200,000 underwater, and it doesn't matter what the payment is. You're $200,000 underwater. People know that. And they have no incentive to make those payments.
No, I agree. The loan modifications have all been
total failure.
Smoke and mirrors and just trying to get somebody to not capitulate. Now, the TARP program, I actually read that document word for word when it was 105 pages. Mm-hmm. And I saw one of the things that was interesting to me, and I'm trying to think of the term. I think it's called crawlback. Have you heard of that term?
Not
okay.
Specifically.
That's when the executives of the lenders have to give all their bonus money back if their companies have to restate earnings during any of those years. So I think that's where the emphasis is. Please, let's keep the loan balance there, but we'll give you 50 years and 3%.
I believe that, and I hope that doesn't work, and I hope that those crawlback provisions take place, because in many ways, the guys that earned the money they did shouldn't have earned it.
Not at all. It wasn't true.
Can I take that thought and run with it for
sure,
a second?
Sure, absolutely.
When you think about the financial markets, and I'm going to get up my soapbox here just for a second, we have to understand that the problems in our financial markets stem, you know, not from some random event or stem from, you know, misratings. They all stem from the problem that the executives in the financial system have been vastly overcompensated on the basis of short-run returns. What you have is a situation where most of these guys and runs, I don't care if it's the S&P or if it's the investment banks or even the guys who are running the hedge funds, all these guys make their money on the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
They make their money on current profits. Well, when you're making your money on current profits, you have every incentive in the world to hide risk, to take excessive risk in the short run and hide that, because by taking excessive risk now, you boost your returns now, and if everything blows up, you're just a manager. You walk away scot-free. Classic case of that, Dick Fuld, CEO of Lehman. The guy made $400 million in 6 years. How did he make $400 million? He leveraged Lehman up to the nth degree, again, borrowed heavily to invest, again, magnifying those profits, and then when the market turned around, it blew up, he walked away from a bankrupt firm, which the United States economy had to clean up for.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sits there in front of Congress and tells Congress he can't sleep at night. Well, if he made $400 million in 6 years, you know, I'd probably sleep fine. I don't know. How about you?
He probably is in the high end of the tax bracket for California.
Exactly. So from that perspective, until we address this problem, until we address the fundamental problem incentives where all these fat cats on Wall Street and the financial system make their money on the here and now, you know, until these guys are forced to have some long-run skin in the game to take long-run responsibility for the decisions they make, we're going to see these things happen again and again and again.
Well, the whole mortgage-backed security did that with the risk of loans.
Well, the whole idea of mortgage-backed security, you know, the idea of a mortgage-backed security sounds good on paper. What are you doing? You're bundling up a bunch of risky mortgages and selling them off from a sort of a risk pool. Oh, I like the idea of risk pools. And then you can sort of tranche off the returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by tranching off the returns, you get to segment the risk. Oh, that sounds good on paper. But, you know, realistically, when these things came into sort of prominence, when these things became hot and, you know, 5-6 years ago, what are you dealing with here? You're not dealing with individual investors owning one mortgage. You're dealing with huge banks owning thousands and thousands of mortgages. They already have an insurance pool. We live in a world in unprecedented access to all sorts of derivatives and financial products. They allow you to change your risk pattern any way you want. We never needed mortgage-backed securities. We never needed them. They weren't there for that. They weren't there to spread risk or minimize risk. They were there to hide risk.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the reason they wanted to hide risk was to boost those short-run profits so they could make that much more money in the short run. That's all it was. It was a tool to hide risk.
And now this is a spinoff of something that was called in the early 1900s, bucket shops. And in 1907, they actually made it illegal, and it was a felony to do derivatives. And in Congress in 2000, they reversed that and made all this possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, we've always had derivatives, right? I mean, derivatives are any classification of a financial product that isn't sort of directly related to a hard asset. You know, futures contracts are derivatives,
mm-hmm.
But we use those all the time. There are uses for these products in many ways, and I'm certainly not against the idea of using derivatives. The problem is it also provides, because they are complex, they are hard to see through, they also provide a perfect conduit for which people who want to hide risk in order to short-run boost their returns to do just that. So you have the circumstance where I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, but I think we have to have realistic understanding of the motivations of the people who run our financial system and understand that the problems we have in the economy today stem from a motivational issue, from one of incentives.
Okay. What do you see as the next shoe to drop for California? Residential's in the tank. What's next?
Well, I mean, the big problem in the U.S. economy, of course, is not real estate. It's not the financial markets. Those are more a symptom of the underlying problem, which is this enormous asset bubble, which has taken place over the last 10, 12 years. Now asset values are returning to normal levels. The problem is that over the last same period of time, 10, 12 years, American consumers have been on a spending binge. Savings rates went into the toilet, went to ridiculously low levels. People borrowed like never before. We ran up this huge trade deficit, all really based on Americans thinking they were rich. You know, you pick up the newspaper today, and you'll see a story in there about a boomer, and you know, 58 years old, was 3 months from their early retirement. They had bought the condo on the golf course in Scottsdale, Arizona. You know, the house was paying for the kids' education, their 401k and mutual fund. They basically set them up for a wonderful retirement of cruises and tennis. And now they're upset because Wall Street ruined their early retirement.
Mm-hmm.
No. Wall Street didn't ruin their early retirement. Wall Street then was making these people think they could retire early in the first place. Their house wasn't worth that much. Their mutual fund wasn't worth that much. Now, the back end, of course, that shock to the system, wow, I'm not rich, but I have lots and lots of debt. What this means is Americans now have to get their spending back in line with their incomes. And that process, while ultimately healthy for the U.S. economy, is very painful in the short run, since so much of our economy is built around feeding consumers the goods and services they want. The tanking of imports, the huge decline in retail sales, this is a direct result of that recalibration process. The problem isn't that we're not buying enough cars today. The problem was we bought too many cars last year.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these trends have to take place. You cannot look to the American consumer to pull us out of this mess, because it's the American consumer that is the mess.
Okay, now, the American consumer, we get up to, say, 70% of that being the consumer being the GDP.
Right.
And that wasn't always true. It used to be somewhere around, say, 62%.
Not quite. It went from about 65 to 71%.
Okay.
Right?
Do you see that declining back to a more normal number or just temporarily?
It absolutely has to decline to a more normal number because remember the back end of that. So GDP is a big pie we all share, right?
Right.
Part of that GDP goes to the consumer, part of it goes to businesses, and part of it goes to government. Well, when consumers increase their spending so much, did businesses spend less? No. Did the government spend less? That would be the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? Well, it was this huge trade deficit. The huge trade deficit we saw was sort of the new twin deficits. In the mid-80s, the twin deficits were the federal deficit and the trade deficit. This twin deficit was the savings deficit and the trade deficit. And what you have to see, you know, in 2 years, here's what the U.S. economy is going to look like. More exports, less imports, less consumer spending, and we have a balanced trade account. This is a healthy economy that's ready to grow for the long run. But again, the process from getting from here to there is very, very painful.
Very painful, not just for us. I'm sure China is not going to appreciate it.
You better believe it.
Now, do you see that their currency is going to have to increase in value?
Absolutely, in the long run.
Okay.
What's interesting is the dollar in the short run is driven by financial considerations, not the trade deficit. But so the dollar is strong right now in large part because of the financial worries in the world. But as those financial worries start to be soothed, as they inevitably will, the only way you can see that trade deficit being closed and staying closed is really through the U.S. dollar going back down again to more reasonable levels against the euro, against the yen, and, of course, most importantly, against the yuan.
We've got about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to touch on a report that I read. You wrote a report, Waiting to Save, A Crisis of the Young Ages 24 to 34, and their habits thus far as their willingness to save.
Right.
And, you know, a lot in I suppose in a lot of ways, they're going to be picking up some tabs that they didn't have anything to do with creating, but they better get busy saving more than they're used to.
Absolutely. And part of the problem, of course, is you think about that age group. These are folks that have been raised in a period of time where savings, if you will, has become sort of passe. It's uncool.
Well, it didn't pay very well either.
Yeah, exactly. You don't save. What you do is you borrow to speculate.
Right.
That's what they've learned to do. And that's a bad lesson. You know, you go back a couple generations to those people who came out of the Great Depression and World War II years, and they learned that to plan for the future, you consume less today, which is a different thing altogether. Now, hopefully, in the back end of this, you will see people being more realistic about their future and what they need to do today to make sure they're prepared for that future.
And
but it remains to be seen.
And actually willing to live below their means instead of above.
You better believe it.
Yeah, because, I mean, all of us probably look at the last couple of years, and if anybody was introduced to that as normal, that certainly was not.
Exactly.
Do you see, and we've got about a minute and a half, defined benefit plans. Now, that's the kind of person that is expecting a certain return no matter what happens.
Well, in general, defined benefit plans have left the room. The only place you still see defined benefit sort of plans is, sadly, in government.
Exactly, the cities and the counties.
And you're absolutely correct, in as much as the kind of benefits that our state and our local governments have promised state workers are just never going to happen.
Well, now, if they're never going to happen, does that mean they have to declare bankruptcy to readjust those?
I don't know. That's a good question. We won't know that for a couple of years because it's going to take that long for this thing to sort of work its way through the process. We'll have to wait and see. But remember, you know, CalPERS has lost 40% of its value.
Yes.
And on top of that, even at the high rate, they were really underinvesting because they were using returns averaged between 1994 and 2007 as a sort of an actuarial basis to see how much they needed to put in it.
Exactly.
Well, those returns were all inflated by this huge national bubble we've been through.
Exactly.
So there's no doubt that the defined benefit plans in the state are in big trouble. The question is when, yet again, will we have the political courage to acknowledge that?
Okay. Well, it sounds like a fun couple of years. Dr. Thornburg, thank you so much for joining us again, and I really enjoyed talking with you and asking all of our questions.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.